Bedheads, welcome to another episode of Sharing Our Pairings. This is Sharing Our Pairings episode 93, Winter Smoky Smoke. Sharing Our Pairings, the show where we pair cigars and beverages. I'm your host, John the Cigar Surgeon. We broadcast on CigarFederation.com, YouTube.com, and of course, rebroadcast on the Armed Forces Radio Network. I'm here with my guest co-host, Trip, a.k.a. Trent. Trip, what's going on tonight, brother?
Not much. Ready to smoke some cigars and drink some scotch.
It does seem like the season for drinking scotch, right?
It sure does, especially Islay, or specifically peated scotch, not necessarily Islay.
I agree. I think for me, there's a time and place for people ask me, you know, what's your favorite scotch? What's your favorite whiskey? It's a time and a place. And for me, nothing beats, I mean, it sounds strange because I hate the cold and I hate winter, but nothing beats sitting out in the winter around a campfire, preferably, with a heavily peated whiskey. It's magical.
Something about it just goes together.
It just goes together. And of course, we're pairing some Neanderthals. And I know the last time we paired some Romacraft cigars, Skip actually commented on the episode that he tends to like bourbon, but we're kind of talking in the green room pre-show. I think, and you said it, that Skippy's stuff tends to pair just naturally with scotch.
Absolutely. And particularly peated scotch for me. It just goes, it's like a hand in hand.
Yeah, I mean, I think so too. It's you know, peated scotches are sometimes really, peated whiskey in general, is sometimes really tough to pair with because the peat can be overwhelming and not a lot of people like peat. That being said, not a lot of people like really full-bodied cigars, and we're kind of smoking, you know, pretty full-bodied cigars by really every measure of full-bodied cigar. But for me, you know, it's they're contrasting, but yet there's parts of it that are complementary, which is why I called it Smoky Smoke, because there's parts of a Neanderthal that overlap, which is the cigar we're smoking tonight. And we're smoking two different Vitolas. So what do you, and I forgot
I think
to
I'm
ask.
I'm smoking the same Vitola. I'm smoking the HN.
Oh, you are smoking the HN. Okay.
The big old baseball bat.
The big old baseball bat. Because I know you had said pre-show you weren't sure whether you wanted to take on the Big Daddy, because this cigar has a bit of a reputation.
A little bit, yeah. It's done me in once or twice.
And I was kind of mentioning pre-show that, you know, I'm not embarrassed to say that I had a chocolate bar sitting by me pre-show, to like a little mini chocolate bar to sort of maintain my calories because I'm cutting calories, but no one cares about that. But the reason I had that standing by was as standby in case the cigar messes me up, because this is, you know, Skip tends to blend medium full to full. That's like medium full is like his floor, and full plus, if that's such a thing, is, you know, his ceiling. And this cigar tends to have a bit of a reputation of knocking people out.
This one might break the ceiling.
Yeah.
With that, I'm going to mess up the name. I forget it every time. Green River Seersucker, I think is what he calls the Lajero that's in this, the double Lajero.
Is that the Dominican Republic Lajero, or is that the...
It's Pennsylvanian Lajero.
Oh, the Pennsylvanian Lajero, right.
And they do that special priming where they pull the leaves off and then leaves grow back rather than just lopping the whole plant down.
So maybe we'll talk about, first of all, before we get into the pairings here, we'll talk a little bit about the blend. So this is the Romacraft Neanderthal Figurado. It's called the HN. I don't know what the HN stands for. Do you know?
I used to know.
It's got to be something.
I don't remember. No, it's something in Latin, I believe.
Oh, interesting.
I'm going to look
Skip
that
is
up.
A deep man. He's a very deep man. If you follow him on Facebook, you'll find that out very quickly. Now, I'm smoking the release, I believe, from last year's show. As you can see, it's got no band on it. And Trent is smoking the one with the band. You want to hold that up for our live audience there? So it's kind of got that orange and white. And what I like about Skip's bands, because I've certainly complained about some manufacturers' bands who don't tell you what the cigar is. You kind of have to decode it. It's still on there. It's just on a stamped embossing, like a stamped portion.
No,
it
is embossed.
It is embossed.
It's definitely kind of like, raised, I guess. It's better than embossed. But it's, I think they're really great low-key bands. They look great, and like a couple other brands, they're very low-key, but they get the point across. I mean, there's something to be said for a huge, beautiful band, but you don't always have to go that route.
Yeah, I think the word I'm reaching for in my head is understated.
Yes, that's the word I was looking for.
Yeah, so it's elegant. It's got a great color scheme. It's got a nice orange. It's like a race car orange rather than a burnt orange. And it's got that nice white highlight on it. It's a cool band. MSRP on these bad boys are $12. You know, they're available. They used to, I think it was released in 2013 as a limited production. And then now it's, as of I think last year or the year before, it's a regular production line.
I think in 2013, it was just the pre-production.
It was just pre-production.
Okay. Last year is when they actually launched it. And it only comes in 50 count boxes.
Woo!
So you're going to be dropping some coin if you want a box of these guys.
Or, you know, plug for the SigFed store, by which I get no money. I checked in the SigFed store, and they're available in the SigFed store. So if you can't get your hands at your local B&M, which, first of all, if you can't get them at your local B&M, ask your local B&M. Definitely ask your local B&M. So the blend, San Andreas Maduro. Skippy also put in a Connecticut Broadleaf Binder, which, you know.
You don't see that every day.
Yeah, why don't you just punch me right in the nads with strength and body, like, good Lord. And then if that wasn't enough, and Trent already talked about it, it's got that Pennsylvania Double Lajero. They call it the GR51, I think is the code name.
GRS1, Green River Sucker 1. That's what it is.
There we go, Sucker 1, okay. And then a pile of Nicaraguan tobacco. One of the origins of tobacco here I really don't see. So it's got Condega, which I love, Jalapa, which has great aromatics to it, Pueblo Nuevo. Don't know where that is, but...
Not familiar with that one.
And, of course, Esteli, because, I mean, Esteli and tobacco, forget about it. And then, if that's not enough, it's got a lure from Dominican Republic. So, I mean, that's a lot of tobacco.
Yeah. And it makes for a real complex cigar.
Yeah. And I think
there's a lot of complexity in here, and it's not over-the-top powerful like you would expect from that kind of profile that you're expecting from that list of leaves, but it ends up being a lot smoother of a flavor experience rather than just a blast of pepper right in the face.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing I think that stands out about the cigar is it starts off, and we're talking about a pre-show, like chewing on a leather wallet with some caramelized brown sugar, and it really belies the amount of power that's beneath this. It does not, like, you know, like you said, a lot of cigars will start out with gobs of pepper, just a blast of pepper, and then they kind of subside. This cigar is one of those cigars that creeps up on you and then punches in the back of the head.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
With Lajero. So, you know.
Double Lajero.
Yeah, double Lajero. So it's a loving Lajero punch in the back of the head, you know. But it's good. And obviously, because it is full plus, really not to be undertaken for the meek. There is a shorter vitola of this. Yeah, I think the shorter vitola is like 4.5 by... Cause
4.5 by 48, I want to say. I think that's I have it right here. 4.5 by 52.
Yeah, so this bad boy is, and I had the size down, but it's a 52-58. So it's a 52 at the tapered point, and it's a 58 at the bat point of the cigar.
Which is at the foot.
At the foot. But it's, so we went with the big bad boy. So halfway through the show, I might run off camera and puke. We'll see. It doesn't happen very often. And surprisingly, I was saying that, you know, I've smoked a lot of Skippy stuff, and I like Roma Craft, and I smoke everything. You know, I smoke from Connecticut Shade all the way up to Skip stuff. And I really don't find that his cigars knock me out. And maybe that's just because I'm going into the experience prepared. You know, I'm not smoking in an empty stomach because I'm not – I don't want to
– Yeah, because you know better.
Yeah, I don't want to be twitching on the ground, sweating and screaming and crying and, you know, whatever help happens with nicotine sickness there. But just for audience, if you're not aware, if you do start to feel sick while smoking a cigar, first of all, stop immediately. Second of all, the best thing you can do is sugar, either straight up sugar or something sugary, like a sugary drink, like a Coke. That will immediately combat nicotine sickness and make you feel a lot better.
Yeah. Sugar under the tongue, particularly, is what I've heard works. Huh. I haven't actually tried that before, but
whatever works, really. I'm actually going to move my lighter to my pocket here because I can already tell that I'm having butane ignition problems because it is getting that cold. It is December, and sometimes December here can be 62 degrees freedom, or sometimes it can be, you know, minus 12 freedom. Right now it's kind of a moderate 24 degrees freedom, which, you know, that's kind of a nice, it's kind of one of those nice winter days where it's super calm and the air is really quiet, and you know, if someone were to shout at the end of the street, you could hear it very clearly, and I kind of like those winter days.
Yeah, those are kind of nice, better than 24 degrees and gusty.
Yeah, I was a little worried because earlier it was snowing like nobody's business. I was like, well, this is gonna be an interesting show because people are gonna see gusts of snow going by the screen. And of course, you know, smoking outside with the laptop exposed, not exactly the best thing. But fortunately, we are safe, and I am eager to get into our first beverage of the night before we get our first break. Win. So, you want to take it off or take it off? Do you want to take off with your first pairing?
Absolutely. I'm starting with one of my favorites here, called Oban.
Mm-hmm.
For people who aren't familiar, because it is one of the smaller distilleries. That's not quite as popular as some of the others, even though it is a very popular whiskey. It's actually a Highland whiskey, but they call it a West Highland whiskey because it's on the coast, and it's more of a marriage between a Highland and an Islay whiskey. So it's a Highland whiskey, but it's also pretty heavily peated. They only make 670,000 liters or 177,000 freedom gallons.
That's a very small production.
And they only have two stills. I didn't know that until I started reading about them today.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
I mean, you think about the amount of production that comes off of two stills, and I think what blows me away, because even on large production facilities, they might only have four to six stills, and they're producing, you know, close to a million freedom gallons of beverage of spirit a year. And then you go to the Japanese whiskey side of things, and they've got like 23 stills or 26 stills. So it's interesting for you know, such a small factory what they can put out.
And another interesting thing that I didn't know about them is that they. The distillery was built in 1794 in the city, which is now called Oban. And there wasn't a city there. There were people who lived there because they could fish in the bay, but there wasn't an actual town or city. It was just kind of a almost village. And then they built the distillery, and the town popped up around the distillery.
If you build it, they will come?
I guess so.
Scotch just can't turn down whiskey. That's just how it rolls. So that's cool. And I call that's kind of my whiskey. I call it the peated training wheels whiskey.
Yeah, exactly. That's a great way to put it.
Because it's, for me, the sort of Talisker and the Oban are in the same category. I would almost qualify them as being smoky rather than that. When I think of peaty, I think of, you know, summertime when you're rolling down, there's highway construction and there's that road tar and that creosote and railway ties. And that to me is what peat is, at least a lot of heavily peated stuff. So those are a little bit on the campfire smoky side of things, I think.
Yeah, it's a little closer to the smoke level of, well, not smoke level, but the smokiness that you get from some bourbons. It's not peaty as much as it is smoky.
So I'll talk about my first pairing in just a moment. I want to remind our audience you're tuned into Sharing Our Pairings, episode 93, Winter Smoky Smoke. We're pairing some Islay whiskeys with Neanderthal from Aromacraft. We are broadcast around the world, heard on the Armed Forces Radio Network, and Sharing Our Pairings is brought to you by Gurkha Cigars, makers of the finest cigars in the world. Go down to your local B&M, ask where they got in Gurkha today. So I'm going to get into my first pairing here, and this is kind of a special one. Interestingly enough, I had not had a dram of this. I poured it for Rob, who, of course, has abandoned us now. But I sent a sampler down to Rob. This is the Kilhoman. And this is as small as distilleries get. They've got the bottle handwritten, the bottle code handwritten on the back of the bottle. This is bottle 1478 of 3000. And, oh, interestingly enough, it's a UK bottle. But this is the 10th anniversary release. And the reason it's the 10th anniversary release is because Kilhoman has not been along very long. Now, you're talking about a distillery that's been open since the late 1700s. Kilhoman was founded and opened in 2005.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. I didn't know that you could still found a Scotch distillery. I thought they were just all full up.
Well, there's been a resurgence, I think, as Scotch demand's kind of hitting its peak now.
Yeah.
There's been a resurgence of opening distilleries. This was sort of one of the batches of the new ones. They're very small. They use the Alt Glean as their water source. They only produce a meager 110,000 liters or 29,000 freedom gallons of production. And as you can imagine, only being open for, well, now 11 years, because they just had their 10th anniversary last year, they don't have a lot of production. They can't sit on a ton of production. So what was cool about this, I'll hold up the dram here to give people a sense of the color. So what's cool about this is, first of all, it's a vatting of sherried scotch and ex-bourbon matured scotch. And they've taken a sample of every bottle they've ever released from the original 2005 all the way to 2012, and includes the sampling, and I'm sure it's probably, you know, a thimbleful, but includes a bit of whiskey from cask number 01, 2005. The very first cask ever produced from the distillery is in this bottle. So, oh, wow. Yeah, I mean, when I heard all that, I was like, okay, that's, first of all, I like their whiskey. It's really good. And second of all, that's a pretty romantic story. I just hope it doesn't suck. And fortunately, I got to try it at a whiskey tasting, and it did not suck. So I bought it. Limited, of course, to just 3,000 bottles. And what's interesting about Kilholman is a lot of their ex-bourbon bottles are specifically Buffalo Trace ex-bourbon bottles.
That's a good bourbon.
I should say, for me. So I'm going to get into the tasting here. And it's quite cold, so I'm having some burn issues, because that's what happens as soon as you go below zero, below freezing, I should say, below 32 degrees freedom. So talking about the nose here, it's actually, the sherry is kind of very prominent in the nose. You get a lot of that sweet sherry, stewed cherry fruit, dark fruit note. And then underneath that, you can really, it's got a coastal quality to it. You know, it's got like a briny, salty, like you're standing on a beach somewhere. And then underneath that, it's like the remnants of a campfire. So not overly peated, but definitely there. So I'm going to take some sips. I'm going to let you talk about your first pairing and how that's going.
So a couple things I didn't mention. This is the Oban 14. So it's obviously been aged 14 years. That's the lowest Oban you can get. They also have an 18, I think, and I think the other one is a 32. Interestingly, they don't even have a website. I don't remember the last time I came across any kind of liquor that had no web presence whatsoever.
You know, you're small when.
Yeah, exactly. And then they've also got a distiller's edition. So this, like most Scotch whiskeys, is aged in ex-bourbon barrels. The distiller's edition is finished in sherry barrels. So I'm sure you and Rob would love that one. I'm not huge on sherry.
No.
Finished whiskey. I prefer a bourbon finish, actually.
Interesting. What do you like about the bourbon over the sherry?
The sweetness that you get only from bourbon, and the smokiness that it adds. Because even with a peated whiskey, it adds another level of smokiness.
I gotcha.
This I'm getting, as soon as you said it, I picked it up. That kind of standing on the beach, saltwater kind of smell. This, you know, there's a little seaweed laying on the beach. I get that from this. A little bit of iodine, but just a touch. Not very much at all.
And what's your feeling on iodine? Because I know that a lot of people are really sensitive to an iodine in a whiskey.
I'm totally fine with it. It doesn't bother me at all. I like it. For me, it's one of those things where it's, like, if it was the only note that I got, I'd probably be completely turned off from that whiskey. Okay. But for me, it just adds another level of complexity that I like. I think this so far is a pretty good pairing with the Neanderthal, because you get kind of that smoky, spicy sweetness from the cigar, and then you get a different kind of smoky sweetness from the whiskey.
I think we're having a very similar start to our night. I get a lot of sweetness off the sherry here, but also a lot of sweetness off the bourbon. And sherry tends to have a lot of pepper to it. So you get, you know, a little, probably a lot more pepper than what you're getting. But that works out right now because I'm not getting a lot of pepper off the Neanderthal. What I'm getting is, again, a lot of the sweetness, a lot of the leather notes. There's sort of a barbecue quality there. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, right now, at the beginning of this cigar, this is pairing really, really well. I'm going to take a couple more puffs and a couple more sips and let this it's got a very short finish, which is surprising for a sherry cask.
Yeah.
I tend to find, I'm definitely tasting a lot more bourbon influence than sherry. Because bourbon's got that almost, you know, that corn sweetness to it. Very short finish, kind of finishes at the sides of my tongue. I find sherry tends to linger at the back of my throat, kind of lasts a long time.
I like this scotch a lot because it's kind of light and sweet like a Highland whiskey, while at the same time it's got that smoky, iodine-y, salty kind of flavor that you get only from an Islay whiskey generally. I think, as you said, this is a great way to start on Islay whiskeys. If you've already had scotch or if you've never had scotch, but you're afraid to get into like the Laphroaigs and the Ardbeg's and all those heavy hitters, this is a good place to start.
Yeah, and I agree. I would absolutely echo that sentiment because I think a lot of people think of peated and, you know, they immediately think of a Lagavulin and a Laphroaig. Mm-hmm. And certainly Lagavulin and Laphroaig are, you know, along with Ardbeg, are really, you know, the three mainstays of what you consider an Islay whiskey. Of course, we say very heavily peated, but there's kind of been this race now, this almost battle with peated whiskeys in the world where it's becoming like IPAs where, you know, nobody's satisfied anymore with having a 45 PPM and that's peated phenols per million or parts per million.
Parts per million of phenol. Phenol.
Yeah, and phenol is a measure of smokiness. So you can scientifically measure, and there is a lot of science behind whiskey, but we won't get into that this episode, but certainly, at 45 ppm, that's a Laphroaig quarter cask, and a lot of people would say a Laphroaig quarter cask is just like crazy, crazy peated, and yet there's lots of companies out there that are putting out 80 ppm, 90 ppm, 110 ppm, or, you know, like the Smokehead, which I think is like 135 ppm, or the Octomores, which I think are 90 plus now.
Spoiler alert, I've got a bottle of Octomore coming up here. This one, I believe, is 167. Yeah, 167 ppm.
Good Lord.
But as I'll talk about when I get to that, it's not as smoky as you would think. It's a little smoother than you would expect.
Just going back to the cigar here. I am retrohaling because I'm a fiend and I love retrohaling cigars. Mm-hmm. I'm getting a kind of a peppery cedar now out of the retrohale. So the cigar is kind of doing that transition now between where it started out as sweet, leathery. Now we're starting to get into really the body of the cigar, and it does, like I said, creep up on you. It starts out sort of medium plus, and then will definitely build to full plus, so I'll be crying for my mama by the end. But as far as pairings go, like you said, we're off to a really good start here, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm not sure any of the others are going to be better than this one, actually.
Yeah, I could certainly stop here, provided a campfire, and I could finish this cigar and I could have a couple drams of this Kilhoman 10th anniversary, I'd be happy camper. Kilhoman, like I said, is a very small distillery. They do have a very unique bottle shape. They have a unique bottle shape. It's kind of a squatter bottle. You can see that they've got sort of bright primary colors in the front of it. And you can find a lot of the releases. They're not all peated. In fact, a lot of their releases were not peated because they're trying to appeal to the broader market. So you'll find a lot of their stuff is sherry cask or even just heavily bourbon cask. So it's really got no peat in it whatsoever. But like I said, I particularly struck this one out because it's got a cool story and because, hey, why wouldn't I? 10th anniversary plus a little peat in there. Yeah. Absolutely.
Now, do you know what region of Scotland they're in?
I do. And I wrote it down. And then I didn't put it in my notes. So I'll have to get back to you on that after we do our first break.
All right.
When you're talking about. But I think, if I remember right, they're located on an island. And I want to say they're northern Scotland. But I might just be pulling that out of my butt. In fact, Yeah, I just recall them being a very tiny distillery in an island, but we'll get confirmation of that when we after we take our first break here. But we'll give it, because I could sit here all night with this. I'd be very happy, but really kind of want to move it along. I'm going to move into my second one, which is kind of one of the bottles. And I don't say this about a lot of whiskeys, but I have a certain number of whiskeys that always have a place in my cabinet. One of them is the Balvenie Doublewood. I know the price of the Doublewood keeps going up. Always be in my cabinet. The Springbanks, I'll always typically have some Springbank, like a 12 or a 15 in my cabinet. So there's a handful. And this is the Lafroy Quarter Cask, which for me is like the quintessential Lafroy. It's ridiculously affordable if you like peat. A lot of times this can be found for less than $40, which, I mean, in this day and age.
Man.
Yeah. I think the last time I picked this up, I picked it up for $36, and I ended up buying two bottles because it's like, well, I'm going to go through it for sure. Hold it up here. So it's got a lighter color. You can kind of see side by side. It's got a little bit of a lighter color, although not, you know, not remarkably. So it's like a golden straw color. And really that's because we're talking, again, about a no-age statement whiskey here. The Kilholman is a no-age statement. They don't print an age statement. We know that the whiskey that's in there has to be a minimum of 3 years by law. But, you know, it's got everything up to the 10-year. And that's just the way it is with the Ford Quarter Cask, exact same thing. It's a no-age statement. It's a blend. But it just goes to show you that you can produce a very, very high-quality product without having to put an age statement on it. Lafroy, of course, is one of the Keystone Islay distilleries, neighboring Ardbeg, Lagavulin, and Port Ellen. They were founded in 1815. Their water source is the Kilbride Dam. And they produce a whopping 2.7 million liters per year, 713,000 freedom gallons, which I think has actually gone up since I last took these notes. And what's interesting about them and really is not being done in the industry anymore is they still malt their own barley.
Yeah.
Most of all of the Islay distilleries now are getting their barley from the Port Ellen malting facility because, quite frankly, they can malt just a crap ton of barley and do it very, very effectively. And no one wants to shovel barley all day. It's a miserable, miserable job, 8-10 hours. And, you know, even if it's cold outside, it's crappy in there because it's hot, it's uncomfortable, it's miserable. But they do it that way. They still employ malt men in the process, which is kind of cool because there are, you know, obviously a limited number of jobs available on Islay. It's a very small island. Talking about the specs on this bad boy, 48% ABV. Now, I can't remember if I said the first one was actually cask strength. The Kilholman was cask strength.
Yeah, we both forgot to talk about the strength.
Yeah. On the first one. So it was 58.2%, and for 58.2%, it's one of those classic ones where if I had to measure, I would have said it was 45 because it's that easy drinking. Alcohol or
The Oban is 43%. So right about standard.
So we're talking already about the PPMs. This is 45 PPM. Very smoky off the nose. But lots of honey, like almost like honeysuckle underneath it. Very sweet. And this launched in 2004. It was, I think, kind of a market-driven decision because there'd been so much Lafroy being bought up. And again, you can't produce that much 10-year age statement whiskey.
Yeah.
Because you've only got so much of it. 10 years ago, you didn't know what the market was going to do 10 years. So you can only produce so much. This is double matured in American oak barrels. So the first barrel is a regular size ex-bourbon barrel, and then the second maturation is in a quarter cask. And the reason that it's a quarter cask is because it's a small, just as it says, it's quarter the size of a regular cask, a lot more wood contact, giggity. And the point of the wood contact is that you get a much faster maturation, you get a lot more influence from the wood in a much shorter period of time. So I'm going to take some sippies and let that settle in because I know it's going to rock my palate a little bit, and I'll let you talk about your second pairing.
So before I talk about mine, I'm going to talk about the quarter cask a little bit. So mine, actually, I'm just going to say mine is Lafroy 10, which is one of my favorites.
It's delicious.
The quarter cask, first of all, for me, it's about double the price. It's like $65 here, which is why I don't usually buy it. So I stick with the 10 most of the time. So the quarter casks, I went to a tasting a couple years ago where they explained front to back, the whole process. The quarter casks are actually bourbon casks. They take half the staves out, and then they put new rings on them. So it's actually the same height cask, but it's a quarter thinner because they've taken half the staves out. I think that's what it was. They might have taken a third of the staves out. It's a math thing. I'm not great at that.
Stupid math. I hate math so much.
So now I'll get into mine. So Laphroaig 10 is the classic Laphroaig. Most people know it as the peated scotch, because if you go into a bar and they only have one peated scotch, it's going to be this one.
Absolutely.
You can get it all over the world. And like John said, they make, like, how many did you say? 2 million liters? 3
2
million?
Point, yeah, 2.7 million liters of production, which is enormous. Because Islay, if you've ever been to Islay, and I have not, but Islay is just such a tiny, tiny island. It's incredible that you can produce that much whiskey from Laphroaig. And they are not considered one of the larger distilleries.
Oh, no. So I'll talk about mine a little bit now. So I get a lot of the same notes as John, as expected. This is essentially the same whiskey as the quarter cask. It just hasn't been in those quarter casks. It's been a little more time in the full size casks, a minimum of 10 years. It's just smoky. You get so much of that peat flavor. I know that at the distillery now they've got like these projectors where they are projecting people's opinions, as they call them, up onto the walls. So things like,
oh yeah. I've seen them. They've got a YouTube video. Yeah.
It's really cool. And so you can submit your own at Laphroaig.com. And if you're lucky enough, they'll put it up in the factory for a couple days.
Just getting back quickly to Kilhoman. I was way, way off. So Kilhoman is actually located on Islay, on the western side of Islay. So it obviously, they're going to get their peat from, presumably from Port Ellen. In fact, it is, of course, from the Port Ellen maltings, because that's where everyone gets their maltings from on Islay, except for Laphroaig.
So I love that Laphroaig, you get a little bit of like a hard candy on the front. Then you taste the iodine seawater kind of flavor, and then it just leaves just the flavor of peat smoke in your mouth. And it's got a really long finish.
Yeah, for 45 ppm, I mean, everyone thinks of this as like just being like chewing on dried peat, but for me, it's, you know, I've had a lot more peaty whiskeys, and certainly a lot more briny whiskeys. For a peated whiskey, it's pretty elegant.
Yeah, I agree. Whenever I, like, if I go out for drinks with coworkers or something and I order this and they say, what's that? Can I have a sip? They taste it. And every time they're like, that tastes like gasoline. It's disgusting.
I think gasoline is exactly the descriptor I normally, like, literally everyone says gasoline. I'm not sure.
Yeah. I don't get it.
Yeah. I don't get gasoline. I mean, certainly, back in the day, I think I described it as like a burning tire.
Yeah,
not
gasoline? That's actually not a bad descriptor of it, because you do get kind of the mix of the iodine and the peat and the smoke, you do kind of get like a tire kind of flavor almost. But it's much more pleasant than it sounds.
Yeah, I think on the Laphroaig, what tends to hit my palate is you get sweetness up front. And the sweetness kind of belies that smoke that chases. And like you said, it finishes smoky. And definitely in the middle, I get that iodine and a little bit of brine. Interestingly enough, I feel like the Kilhoman had a lot more brine going on than the Laphroaig. So it's interesting now that I'm sort of doing them side by side. The quarter cask has much less brine than the Kilhoman. And the, like you said, on my quarter cask, I'm also getting a much, much longer finish as well. Where the Kilhoman had a short finish, the quarter cask is definitely lingering significantly. Oh, yeah. Like I can do 2-3 draws and I'm still getting that quarter cask.
Yeah, you still taste that peat.
Yeah.
And then for anybody who doesn't know, there's also the triple wood, which is essentially the whiskey goes from the full-size cask to the quarter cask to then a sherry cask, I believe, right?
Yeah, I think that's true. And I'm fairly certain
it's a sherry cask.
Yeah, and I actually got that, and it's really good.
Yeah, I really like that one. And actually, the tasting that I was talking about earlier, we tasted the 10... the quarter cask, the triple wood, then it was the 18 and the 25. And my favorite was the triple wood. Over the 18 and the 25.
Yeah, I've got the triple wood, and I kind of echo that sentiment. The triple wood is just a fantastic combination of different cask influences. It's very elegant, and again, gotta love it. Very affordable. I think up here the triple wood's around $70-$75.
Yeah, that's about what it is here.
Yeah, very affordable. It's interesting to me that the quarter cask is so expensive for you.
I don't understand why. It's much more expensive than the 10.
Which makes no sense, because that's a complete opposite of the intent of the quarter cask. It's a no-age statement whiskey. It should absolutely be cheaper than the 10-year.
Yeah, it's bizarre.
Very strange. So yeah, whenever, like I said, whenever there's a Christmas special, which tends to be when the Lefroy quarter cask goes on sale, my butt is off to the liquor store to pick up 2-3. Drink them during the Christmas, you know, January, February, or January, February, March, and then kind of sits at the cabinet until the fall.
We actually had, this bottle came from a pricing error that apparently happened. So the normal price for Lefroy 10 here is $49.95.
Okay.
And for their 200th anniversary in 2015, they ran a promotion that was supposed to be like 20% off, and the intention was to take $22 off the price. And somehow across the entire state, nobody noticed, but they marked it down to $22.95 a bottle.
Woo! How many bottles did you get?
I bought 5.
Yeah, I would have been all over that.
I've got 1 left now.
So
I like my Lefroy.
So do you tend to, like I said, the quarter cask is really one of the definitive bottles in my cabinet. So it sounds like the 10 for you is kind of the same.
The 10 is a standby for me. I've always got to have it.
Nice. Well, I'm getting into the sort of finishing the first third of the Neanderthal, and I am smoking it at a leisurely pace because, again, I don't want to have my butt kicked live on the internet. Or pre-recorded, I should say, on the internet. And it is starting to get into the smoky, toasted, malty part of the cigar where that brown sugar is kind of taking a little bit of a turn, more of the barbecue meat flavor, more of the toasted nuts, and still getting lingering pepper, post-draw, and pepper on the retrohale. But again, you know, when we talk about pepper, there are a lot of sticks out there that are significantly more pepper. This is very subdued. I normally associate pepper and Lajero, but it really comes down to how you blend it. This is not a pepper bomb. It is
not at all.
Not at all. It's like for, you know, I would kind of qualify this as like being the same as a cask strength spirit that drinks like it's, you know, half of what the ABV is because it does sneak up on you. Don't recognize how strong it is because it doesn't present that way.
The flavors are very surprisingly restrained and it's surprisingly complex. Because with a cigar that's 58 ring gauge and has this many different leaves and this many Lajero leaves in it, you expect it to just blow your face off. Mm-hmm. And it's just such a complex, smooth almost cigar. I kind of don't want to use the word smooth because it's not quite smooth, but it's definitely more restrained.
Very balanced.
Balance is the right word, but maybe not as far as the strength goes. It's not balanced with the strength.
Now, one of the things we didn't talk about is it's got a flat cap, and that's kind of a style choice. I tend to not like the flat caps, mostly because, frankly, they're a pain in the butt to cut.
Agreed.
So, you know, an expert or a person who's a general cigar smoker who's smoked a lot of cigars will not screw up the cut. Someone who's a newbie probably shouldn't be smoking the cigar anyways, but
I've screwed up a couple times.
Yeah, I've screwed up a few times too. So I normally would use my, and this is my product plug for the night. I'm not getting paid for this, although I should. So there's my Zycar V cutter. This has really been my cutter for almost 3 years now. It's my standard cutter. It does not work on the flat cap. So I've got my standby. This is kind of my cool Calibre V cut. Now, I love
deep
that.
V.
It's the deep V. It's got the deep V. So a little bit deeper than what I wanted to cut on the cap, but I'm happy for a V cut. I like the performance of a V. It tends not to screw up the cap, even though it's a deep V, but that's kind of how I went. And so, like I said, so far so good. Really, really enjoying the cigar. And obviously I'm still conscious, so it hasn't knocked me over just yet.
So with the original release of the HN, this size, which was the first Neanderthal that was available on the market, those 50 count cabinets actually came with a, a razor blade, one of those single-sided butterfly blades.
Oh, cool.
Just taped to the inside of the box to shave the cap off. And they stopped doing those. And I actually asked Skip, like, what's your preferred way to cut them? Like, do you use the razor or did you just include that because it was kind of cool?
He's probably a gangster and just uses his fingernail like a PIMP.
No, he doesn't. He's actually, as you may have noticed, the Monolith box that came out a couple weeks ago.
Which is a very cool package.
It's really cool. It comes with Zycar scissors, which are his preferred method. And I said, show me how to cut a Neanderthal. And what he does, which is now what I do, is he kind of holds the cap flat and then takes the scissors and just rotates the cigar around with the scissors. So you're just barely skimming the cap off. Because with these, they actually cut the cap and then put a cap on. Unlike a normal Parejo where they obviously mold the cap and then just cap over it.
Incidentally, if you have the opportunity to go to the Nicasueño factory, very cool to do a tour. I've been there a couple times and hopefully get a chance to go back there again because it's a very cool, smaller factory, kind of approaching a mid-size factory now with his production. He's kind of wrapping up. He does a couple different blends now through the factory, which is really cool. And what I like about the blends that are done from the factories, they're not Romacraft. Like, you can tell the influence of the factory, but they're unique products that are not copycats of what he does already, which is kind of
cool. You don't think you're smoking a Romacraft when you smoke those. And it's also run differently than other factories. It's a very non-classic factory, very contemporary in the way that it's designed and run.
And he has very cool corporate processes that really are designed to maximize efficiencies, little tiny efficiencies, just thousands of little efficiencies in the factory every day, which allows him to produce and maintain a certain level of quality in production that you wouldn't otherwise get out of a factory that size, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, it's a really cool factory. I'm a big fan.
So just a reminder, audience, you're tuned into Sharing Our Pairings, episode 93. I'm your host, John the Cigar Surgeon, joined by my guest co-host, Chirpy Trent. We are smoking some Neanderthals from Romacraft and some Islay whiskeys, Smoky Smoky Smoke, having our winter Smoky Smoke. We are broadcasting the Armed Forces Radio Network. Thanks for all of our Armed Forces Radio Network listeners. You're out there. Hope you're staying safe and hope you're a little bit warmer than I am tonight because I am bundled. Got to keep that Twig and Berries nice and toasty because I'm going to need that someday. Getting on to the last pairing of the night. And I thought I had this bottle open, but I did not, and no Islay whiskey pairing would be complete. Well, I should have had a Lagavulin, but no whiskey pairing would be complete without the Ardbeg. And this is a particular Ardbeg. What I like about Ardbeg is they have an Ardbeg Day, and an Ardbeg Day they release a new bottle. This was released in 2013. I did not get my hands on it and did not taste it until, I want to say, early this year. I was at a tasting. It was a vertical Ardbeg tasting, and I was invited by some good friends. Shout out to Kurt who got me an invite it's a private whiskey tasting club, and I really appreciated the invite and got to taste a vertical of all of the I want to say high end Ardbeg stuff that had ever been released. So a lot of like 25-year-olds. 22-year-olds, and the Ardbeg was one of those that was on that list, along with the Ugadel and all the other delicious Ardbegs that are out there. And I really like the Ardbeg, but it is a bit of a divisive whiskey. I think there's a lot of Ardbeg-like people who love Ardbeg who did not like this. Now, you can see, first off, hold this up, and I'll put my cigar in my mouth and mumble. So if you look at this and then compare it to that one, which is a
Oh, that's dark.
It's way darker. And it's not an age statement, but when you look at that, you can definitely tell that this has spent, it's got a lot more wood contact. It's changed the color for sure. Talking quickly about Ardbeg before we get into the specs, they're founded in 1815, so they go back a ways. Only 1.3 million liters, so Laphroaig is producing more than Ardbeg, surprisingly. It's 295,000 freedom gallons, but they are increasing production, continuing to increase production. They actually closed down for a while in 1983, kind of some market issues, and then reopened in 1989. And as per all the, like we talked about it, all the other Islay whiskeys other than Islay distilleries, other than Laphroaig, they get their peated malt from Port Ellen. So typically an Ardbeg is peated to 55 ppm, which is why I've got this one last. So 10 more ppm than the Laphroaig. And this is, they've traced back that this is probably a 10-year, minimum 10-year. But there is no age statement in the bottle. They expect that this is probably a 10-year. 52.1%, so a little bit higher than the Laphroaig, but less than the Kilholman. And it's a, and I think the color on this comes from the interesting combination of ex-bourbon fill and a I'm going to get this, I'm going to jack this name up so bad, Manzanilla Sherry, which is a Fino Sherry cask. And I don't run across a lot of Manzanilla ex-Sherry cask. Usually it's Pedro Jimenez or can't think the other name at this particular moment, but this is very, I don't tend to see many whiskeys with that at all. And it also got the World Whiskey Award 2014 as the best Islay whiskey no age statement. So it is, again, it's a no age statement, but the whiskey geeks out there have figured out that this is probably a 10-ish. Talking about the nose, again, very sweet, very stewed fruit, and got a much more briny quality in the nose than the Lagavulin or the Laphroaig. But there is like a shoe leather underneath that, like a sweet shoe leather, and almost approaching like some oranges, like an orange rind. So I'm going to take some tastes here, and Tripp, let you talk about your last pairing of the
night. All right. So as I mentioned earlier, I've got the Octomore from Bruichladdich. Bruichladdich was founded in 1881, but they've had kind of a storied history where I don't think they've ever gone more than maybe 30 years without closing for a few. I'm just looking at the times. They were closed from 1907 to 1918. They were closed from 1929 to 1935. They were closed in 1941 to 45, and from 94 to 2000. So they did have about a 50-year run where they weren't closed at all. But they've had sort of a storied history, and their marketing is much more modern than most of the other distilleries, particularly on Isla, because Isla is very traditional kind of packaging for all of the whiskeys. And as you can see, this stark black bottle with nothing but yellow and – or actually kind of gold and silver text – is very striking when you see it. And it comes in a similarly packaged or a similarly decorated tube as a lot of whiskeys do. This is actually only aged for 5 years, but as we discussed before, it's super heavily peated. Mm-hmm. The only whiskeys that are more peaty are newer versions of the Octomore, because somebody else must be catching up, because I think they're up to 208 ppm now.
Yeah.
Which is insane. This is the 6.1. So this is the sixth release. And the 0.1 means that it is the 5 years straight out of the cask. And it is, of course, cask strength. There is also a 0.2 version, which is where they age it in an additional cask for a couple of years, usually about two. Let me see what this one is. 57% alcohol.
Ooh.
So it's
a Hita.
Kind of a Hita, but not super strong. On the nose, you get a surprisingly small amount of smoke, but there's a lot of kind of pear and apple and a little bit of I guess the kind of ocean water brininess on the nose. Another interesting thing about Bruichladdich that I meant to mention is most of their scotches are unpeated, and they're on Islay.
Which is weird, right?
Very weird. And they were obviously they were around before the first one that you had that I can't recall the name right now.
Lagavulin?
No, the one that you just had, number one.
Oh, Ardbeg. Kilholman.
Kilholman, yes.
Kilholman.
You know, they've been around since the 1800s, and I don't know what they were making up until before about 2000.
Mm-hmm.
but most of what they make now is unpeated. And then they've done.
It's so weird because people automatically hear Islay whiskey, or at least people who drink a lot of scotch, hear Islay whiskey and they go, okay, well, it's going to be peat bomb. You actually have to struggle to find a heavily peated, and that's why they have the Octomore. You have to struggle to find a very heavily peated Burclaw product.
They've actually got their names lined up so that you know. Anything that says Brooklady in big letters on it is not peated. If it says Port Charlotte, that means it's heavily peated, sort of like Laphroaig or Lagavulin or Ardbeg. And if it says Octomore, that means it's extreme peat.
Now, that being said, I've got quite a few of the Port Charlotte bottles. I've got some Port Charlotte pre-closure bottles.
Oh, wow. Pre-94?
Yeah, it goes older than that, actually.
Oh, wow.
It's really good and really opened my eyes to what can come out of Islay. And I think what's, like you said, what's really cool is you've got four or five different distilleries in Islay all producing similar product in a sense, but all very, very different taste profiles.
Yes, very different. Which harkens back kind of to cigars, because they're, you know, almost every manufacturer in Nicaragua is in Esteli, and a lot of them use product from Esteli, and there's just a huge range of flavors that you can find there.
So talking about...
I'll go ahead and taste this. And you can...
You take a sip. So this Ardbeg Ardbog, you know, even though it's 55 ppm, again, what's shocking about this is that, especially if you're used to peat, it does not blow you away with peat. It's very balanced, very nuanced, way, way more briny than the Laphroaig, way more briny than the Cajoman. It's almost like eating sardines where, I mean, it's just so salty. Like my mouth is so dry from taking a drink that all I can taste is that salty brine. And the smoke does tend to linger, but it's kind of a match between the salty briny and this intense sweetness. And then again, you get that smoke afterwards. But for 55 ppm, it's just so balanced. You know, this is not a super, super smoky, overpowering Islay whiskey, which, again, I think, you know, Islay whiskeys have gotten this moniker of being crazy smoky, crazy peaty. And yes, like the Octomore is quote unquote crazy peaty, but I'll let Trent talk about how peaty that really is when you take a couple sips.
Yeah, I think it's actually, it certainly has less of a peaty finish than the Laphroaig. You actually get more of the peat up front, and then it has a sharp drop off, and you just are left with kind of the sweetness. Kind of a fruity sweetness, maybe an apple sweetness, which I've never had another Islay whiskey that has barely any apple flavor, because that's something that's usually like Lowlands or Speyside. Mm-hmm. But it's really not as peaty as I was expecting it to be.
Yeah, what's interesting is, and I've talked to some of the people that do peated whiskey at various tastings. They've had some people from the factory there. They've had some of the distillery masters there, which has been a lot of fun. One of the things that's interesting and I think counterintuitive in my mind is that the longer you age a peated whiskey, the less peated it becomes. In my mind, I would assume that, you know, it's sitting in a cask, the peat is just kind of sitting there, the phenols are stewing, it'd get more and more smoky over time, but it's exact opposite. So you have a very old 21 or plus year peated whiskey, the peat is almost gone.
That's exactly why I think I don't enjoy the Laphroaig 18 and 25 as much as I do some of the younger expressions, is because you just don't get that peat character that they're known for as much.
No, it falls off. And again, you know, talking about just repeating the age statement piece, when you set an age statement in by Scottish distillery law, if it's an 18 year, you can't put younger product than an 18 year in there. You can put older product in there, but the minimum age statement is 18 years. So again, it does, for me, past 15 years, I think it really sharply starts to drop off. Mm-hmm. Past 21, you'd be really, and I find this with some of the Scotch Malt Whiskey Society bottlings that they do, single cask bottlings from the distilleries, from a lot of the Islay distilleries, and Some of them approach 22, 25 years, and you'd really be hard pressed to put your finger on what distillery it comes from, even though you know it's Islay, because the peat quality has just dropped off so much that it's become a very, very different whiskey than what you used to from that distillery.
You know, tasting and smelling this again, I'm tasting a lot more black pepper than I was at first, which is interesting. I think this scotch is actually more peppery than the cigar at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And a little bit of citrus, maybe like a lemon, and kind of a it's got kind of an oily texture.
Mm-hmm.
Which I like, because that way the sweetness kind of sticks on your palate. I think that might be part of what keeps it from being overly smoky tasting when it's actually 167 BPM.
Yeah, and I think what's nice about an oily mouthfeel to a whiskey is that it keeps your mouth, like I said, with this Ardbeg, it's got a very drying characteristic. And maybe that's why a lot of people don't like the Ardbeg, because it's so drying in the mouth. It's very, you almost really want to have a sip of carbonated water, regular water, between sips, because your mouth dries out so much, versus the Octomores, where you get that nice, rich, oily texture that just coats your palate and doesn't let your mouth dry out.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. This doesn't have any of that, like, sucking the moisture out of your palate kind of feeling that you get from a particularly cask-strength whiskeys. And I think the cigar is actually overpowering a little bit, because it is a very surprisingly – I mean, it's got a punch of flavor at the beginning, but I feel like I kind of lose some of the finish to the flavors of the cigar.
Mm. Well, I'm definitely finding the I don't think the Ardbeg is the right pairing. I mean, the sweetness has come back on the Neanderthal here, getting into the middle third, but it's not enough to offset that just intense, super salty mouthfeel. So they're very, very contrasting. And in this case, not as enjoyable for me as the quarter cask, and certainly not as enjoyable as the Kilholman. I think I'm kind of thinking back to your first pairing with the Oban 14, thinking, boy, I bet that was probably the...
I think that was the pairing of the night.
I think I could see that, because you've got that perfect mixture of nice, sweet, bourbon-y quality with the nice peaty quality, smoky quality, without sort of jacking up your palate.
Yeah. And I'm surprised that this is getting overrun, but I think it kind of is. I think this is not the best pairing. This isn't a pairing I would recommend. It's a great whiskey and a great cigar, but they just are too contrasting.
Yeah, and I'm kind of in the same way. I think as sometimes the pairing goes, I think the Kilholman 10th anniversary has been my favorite pairing of the night. Quarter cask is a very close second. It's a no-brainer pairing, especially at the price point, especially how readily available it is. The Ardbeg wouldn't be in my collection if I didn't love it, and I do love it, but not the right pairing with the Neanderthal. And, I mean, you can definitely understand, having smoked the Neanderthal now, understanding why Skip tends to like the bourbons, because, you know, you do get that contrasting, peppery, very sweet, corny, smoky quality to it, which is kind of where we're landing with the scotches tonight.
And the kind of, while those flavors are contrasting, you get the complementary flavors of the kind of brown sugar sweetness from the cigar, with the molassesy kind of sweetness that you usually get from a bourbon.
Yeah, absolutely. So definitely Kilholman for me was the pairing of the night. Oban was the pairing of the night for you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Fantastic. I want to thank everyone who's tuned into our pre-record episode of Sharing Our Pairings, episode 93, Winter Smoky Smoke. We'll be back the following week, which will be getting kind of the middle of December. I think we might have to get into some heavy, thick, black, rich stouts. Even though
I was thinking before we started that I think that it's time to do a winter beer pairing. I have some fantastic winter beers around here, and I'm ready to get into those.
And that's kind of my, you know, beyond stouts, that's kind of my love when the winter spiced ales come out.
Oh, yeah. You know, Vassels and all those.
Just fantastic. Great time of the year for that. We'll see if I can manage my calories effectively to allow for three beer samplings. I want to thank all our Armed Forces Radio Network listeners who are out there. As Rob used to say, you guys are built to do things we are not built to do, and we appreciate that you tune in to our show and hope you've been entertained for this 58 minutes. And as we lead into Christmas, hope you get some downtime, some rack time, some chill time.
Some but again, appreciate.
And some cigar time. Absolutely. So thanks again. We'll be back next week for a live episode, hopefully, of Sharing Our Pairings, where we'll freeze my twig and berries off. And as we were saying, Sharing Our Pairings, drink better, but drink less. And welcome to the After Dark segment of Sharing Our Pairings.
And we're fucking back.
We're fucking back. It's a little chilly tonight. I'm not going to lie.
I'm not going to lie, I'm sweating in my coat here.
You're sweating.
I'm going to unzip here.
So what's funny for me in the cold weather environment is that I can dress, like my core is quite warm. I've got some, you know, super warm socks on, and that's good. But I find the fingers and hands to be tough, you know, like I could wear really, really warm gloves, but then it's really tough to...
You lose too much dexterity.
You lose too much dexterity. And this is my challenge to anyone in the industry who's listening. What I really want is someone to come out with a really, really good, thin smoking glove that is good to... Now, granted, you can't have a glove this thin that's good to minus 7 freedom. That's just impossible. But if someone could come out with a glove that's good down to about 0 degrees freedom... at least for an hour and a half, I'd be super stoked because I've got these, you know, sort of gloves that are designed for really it's for smartphones and they're good for about 35 minutes. Mm-hmm. And after about 35 minutes, I really just start to lose fingers.
Oh, yeah.
Feeling in my fingertips.
Well, and the problem that I have with those kind of gloves is after a couple cigars, they stink to high heaven.
Oh, yeah. Everything stinks to high heaven. And I think that's really I certainly find in the wintertime. Because the humidity levels are so low, and it's kind of an interesting thing that I found. My significant other does not like cigar smoke. She hates cigar smoke. But what's curious is we've been down to Cuba, we've been down to Mexico, and she does not mind the smell of cigar smokes. And I had some, I think I had a 1502 and some other, like, you know, hugely Nicaraguan cigars down there, and she didn't mind the aromas and the smoke at all. And I think that has to do with the humidity levels. The humidity tends to sort of capture that smoke, take it away.
Yeah.
Versus the wintertime where, I mean, I can tell right now, it's just soaking into my clothes.
Yeah, it's just seeping in.
It's seeping right in. So I think one of the things we want to talk about in our After Dark segment, and this is your fair spoiler warning. So anyone out there who is not cut up to episode 9 of Westworld, please tune out because we're going to talk about little bit about Westworld. Oh, yeah. And I don't want to spoil it for anybody, as Rob did a couple episodes ago, kind of dropped some spoilers.
Dropped the G-bomb.
Dropped it. Now, you know, it's not cool, bro. I'm not, you know, very anti-spoiler policy, both on Facebook and on my podcast, so not cool. So if you have not caught up on Westworld, or if you've not watched Westworld at all, first of all, go see it.
Go watch it. It's the new Game of Thrones. It's going to be Game of Thrones level once
Game of Thrones. Sci-fi Game of Thrones. Yeah, it's fucking baller. So I'm going to take a little sippy here and get my palate jacked back up.
Oh, yeah, I got to do that.
Love that cork cask. Oh, so good. So good. So, of course, I am watching Westworld with my significant other, who's a big sci-fi nerd, which is most certainly beyond the fact she's hot, what attracted me to her. So I can't watch Westworld without her. So I went away to Nicaragua for like 10 days, which essentially for us meant 3 weekends. And so I was, you know, at that point, I think I was 5 episodes of Westworld behind.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So we have
so much.
So we have binge watched between Friday, Saturday, and Saturday night. We binge watched and are caught up now to episode 9. And you probably didn't tune in, but I did a Westworld mid-season show with Dave Burke of Cigar Jukebox. So if you've not tuned in to Cigar Jukebox, absolutely tune in. Beyond the fact that it's a cool show, he does a really unique pairing of cigars and music. He's got special guests on, industry people. Very cool show, hosted out of Australia. And we did a mid-season break, and I just want to just kind of pat myself on the back that at first I didn't have this show figured out, but I got this show figured out now, at least for this season. I think I got it.
I think so too. I think that like in the first half of the season, like I watch it with my wife too. And like, it's one of those things where there was one week where she was too tired to watch it. She was out doing something. I don't know. For some reason, we didn't get to watch it on Sunday night.
Yep.
Monday morning before work, I was like, I got to watch this. I can't wait. And she was a little upset with me. but I've been just spitting out theories the whole show. Like, that guy's actually that guy. That guy's a robot. That girl's a robot. That person's a robot. These are two different timelines. And a couple of them actually stuck, which surprised me.
So now, I completely forgotten his name because I've had three whiskeys, but the guy who works for Ford, what is his name again? What is his?
Bernard,
right. So yeah. One of the things they said at the mid-season is that, and it's kind of like it reminds me of Battlestar Galactica, where you're trying to figure out who's a Cylon and who's not.
Yeah.
And I said, well, obviously there's no way Bernard can be a quote-unquote Cylon or a host because he's got a wife, he's got a kid. Now, I just want to say that's bullshit what they pulled. That's bullshit.
Well, no,
it's bullshit.
I disagree with that. So what I had said, like, I think it was episode one or two where he showed him the picture and he said, this is me and Arnold. And then it showed you the little flashback of bizarrely young Anthony Hopkins.
Yeah.
Which that's a really cool effect.
It's a very cool effect.
I'm kind of glad, like one of my friends, I was talking to him about it and he said, I wish we got to see more of that young Anthony Hopkins.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like the effects aren't at the point where you could have a whole scene with that. But having just like one shot that pans across or something like that, or just a very short shot with him.
It's very convincing.
It's very convincing. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
But when you
if you had taken someone from 20 years ago and showed them, they'd have no clue that that was a CGI effect. They'd have
exactly.
no clue.
Yeah. It's very, very good. But when Ford showed Bernard the picture of him and Bernard or him and Arnold,
mm-hmm.
I was like, that picture's going to be Bernard. And then it cuts to the picture and it's not. And I was like, oh, I guess not. He's not a robot.
Now what's weird, and I'm just going to throw out my mid-season theories because most of them have come true. First of all, I had said that, I watched it.
William. That's what you're looking for.
No, I was thinking of the lady who I...
Oh, Eleanor?
No, the blonde who's the main host character.
Oh,
I'm not prepared for this Westworld discussion at all.
Dolores.
Dolores, thank you.
Yes.
So I'd said the show is really about Dolores. It's not about the guests. It's not about the man in black. It's not even about Anthony Hopkins, Ford. It's about her. And this whole thing about the maze is about her and that she's going to be the person at the center of the maze. And I accurately predicted, first of all, that she killed Arnold. I said, I'm pretty confident you're going to run into something that she killed Arnold. And second of all, the two timeline theory called that the stuff.
I wasn't convinced about that actually.
You weren't convinced about that?
There's too many inconsistencies.
Okay. With,
like Dolores talking to Bernard and with, there were a couple other things that I was like, it's too inconsistent that there are certain characters that are in both timelines when it's 30 years apart and Dolores is the oldest host. But
they're not in both timelines. That's the thing. It's like, if you
exactly.
look and yeah. And I have to go back and rewatch the first 9 episodes, which now I can do.
I think they're going to reveal some of the loopholes. Like the one loophole that I think is still there is when the ugly Hemsworth brother, I forget mm-hmm. his name. But he was in like the control area and some lady said, we've got a rogue host that's going off script.
Yeah.
And he said, who is it? And she said that it was Dolores, I think. She might have not even specified. Yep. But then they sent that guy, the sheriff, and he said, like, come with me. Then William came out, and he was like, no, she's with me. He was like, okay, fine, and just left. I still don't know what that is. Because was obviously in two different timelines at this point. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
they definitely played
fast and loose with making you think it's the same timeline, but I've started to pick up. It's almost like Game of Thrones where I have to go back and see little nuggets.
So do you know what I noticed? So
what's up?
We saw more of it in the latest episode 9, but where Dolores is in that basement talking to Bernard.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the same basement where Bernard brought Teresa.
Correct.
And killed her.
Incidentally, for the record, I'm not convinced that Teresa was a human being. Teresa might actually be a host. Just throwing that out there.
Oh.
Yep.
But the episode before that, we saw a scene where Bernard was talking to Dolores, which we now know is Arnold. But I was like, that's the same basement. They're in the same basement.
Uh-huh.
And of course they were. I did think that when they looked in that little window and they said that he has this machine that can build a host in 2 to 3 days, I thought that was going to be Teresa, that he was going to build a host of Teresa and send her back, and she was going to be just doing his bidding.
I'm still not entirely convinced that the Teresa they killed was not somehow a host, because now, you know, I have to operate by the Battlestar Galactic theory that everyone's a Cylon.
Everyone's a host.
Right, until I've been proved otherwise. And that's why I was so convinced that he was, that Bernard was not a host, because I was like, well, he's got a wife, he's got a kid, you can't fake that. Everyone, you know, they would have done a background, and that's where I think where there's a loophole, is that the corporation obviously would have done a significant security check and background check. They would have saw that he had a wife, they would have saw that he had a kid. So I think that's a bit of a loophole, because there's no other corporation that tight wouldn't have caught on to that.
That loophole and the one with the Hemsworth brother.
Mm-hmm.
That makes me wonder if everyone who works there is actually a host.
Whoa!
Because, I mean, imagine you've got this entire crew of people that work for Westworld, mm-hmm. and they never leave.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it can't be like a cruise ship where they take 3 month stints.
Yeah.
It seems like a lot of these people have been here for a long time. And that would explain some of the weirdness.
Is it Elise that just got murdered?
Elsie.
Elsie. So Elsie is definitely dead. Well, at least presumably dead. I have to operate by the nobody
seems
no
to
death.
Care.
Nobody seems to care. But they were talking about her being on break. And they also were talking about Douchebag McDoucherson, who was the other...
The British guy.
The British guy.
Yeah.
Who's,
who got fired and then was mysteriously back.
Yeah, and also Bernard, by the way, so talking about corporate security, so Bernard's fired. As they say from McGlinger, Glenn Ross, they fired his fucking ass. And
they
yet
did.
Somehow he's walking around the facility.
Yeah, and they're just like, go ahead. We
it's
don't
like,
care.
I don't know if anyone out there has been fired from a corporate position or laid off, but let me tell you this.
They don't let you hang out in their underground bunker.
They don't let you hang around. When you're fired, first of all, security comes in and escorts your ass out immediately.
Yeah, the Hemsworth guy would have walked him right out.
Would have walked him right out. All your quote-unquote security and passwords and shit. Sometimes that trigger is pulled before you even fired. They are on top of that.
Oh, they're ready.
There's no way that Bernard is walking around this facility after being fired, and I think that was a bit of a misstep from the writers. Bernard's fired. He's fucking fired. He's not walking around that facility. They wrapped that up where Ford was like, oh, I'm going to convince the board to bring him back and blah, blah, blah. And yeah, I get that. But that time between the point where he's fucking fired and the point where he's walking around the facility is bullshit. He would not be allowed in the park, around the park. He would be out of that park
gone.
Immediately.
He'd be outside.
He's gone.
Waiting for a cab.
You gone. So, that being said, like I said, the theory I had about Bernice? Dolores.
Dolores.
Bernice. Woo! I'm not prepared to talk about Westworld at all. So, the point at which she was all of that part of her, I predicted her killing Arnold. I predicted, so I'm glad I kind of had the pulse of the show. But you know, I did not expect. I said when I was watching episode 9, I'm like, well, Ford's gonna die here. Like, there's no question, Ford's gonna get his ass capped by Clementine. I'm like, well, like, and you know, when Bernard,
That was that was totally surprising.
That was totally surprising. And it's good to see they still have surprises that, you know, Bernard's like, I'm like, well, there's no way Bernard's going to shoot him because he can't. And you know, Ford's smart enough to have backdoors and codes and backups. And then he gave it to her, to Clementine. I'm like, aha, very smart.
Yeah, very smart.
Because we know she's a psycho. And then when it came time to kill him...
And they drilled her brain out.
They drilled her brain out, which was, you know, horrifying.
Well,
But yeah, they've still got some great twists and turns. I'm really looking forward to seeing kind of what they build with the second season. They've kind of with one of the Helmsworth brother who got jumped by the spooky ghost Indians. I mean, first of all, when he was like
freeze, I have a couple theories about those guys too.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'll let you talk about that. I was gonna say when he said freeze motor function, and they did not freeze. Listen, like, I'm fucking pulling the trigger immediately. Like, those guys are getting capped because shit's, like, if they're not responding, that means shit's gone sideways and maybe they can injure you. I would have been capping dudes left, right, and center. And he's a security guy. I was expecting him to start blasting these dudes immediately, and he did not pull the trigger once.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly where they're going to go with that, but I have three different theories. Let me see if I can remember all three. The first theory is that those are hosts that have gone crazy. Okay. They've, you know, sort of like Maeve. Yeah, Maeve. Sort of like how Maeve broke her loop and got out of it. Right. Those are hosts that something happened that triggered them, and they were able to work their way out of their loop. Okay. And now they're free. Second theory is that those are crazy park goers, guests, who somehow got all the way out there and got involved in the, I think they're called the Ghost Nation. I think that's what they call them. And they have taken on their identities kind of because they're now broken people who are crazy. And the third theory is that Maeve said she was going to build an army. The third theory is that they are part of Maeve's army.
So now it's some kind of other alternate third timeline that Maeve has fucked with these Ghost Nations and they're her army.
Yeah.
Interesting. Now, let me ask you this, because there's obviously going to be – they're going to have to drop some – I think it's 10 episodes, right? It's
not 13, there's one more episode, and then season two starts sometime in 2018.
2018, which is bullshit, by the way.
Oh, it's so far away.
Game of Thrones-level bullshit. So, obviously, they're going to have some major twists planned and some cliffhangers planned for episode 10.
There's going to be some big twists, I think.
Big twists. So there was a lot of stuff with Teddy, which was really interesting. They've taken Teddy from this milquetoast character who was really painful to watch and made it very interesting in his background and his storyline. I think we can say – so I'm going to throw this out there. I think we can safely say at this point that the Man in Black is the dude that fell in love with Clementine.
William. Would you agree with that? Yes, William. I agree with that.
Okay. Especially the point where he says, don't fucking call me Billy. I think he said, don't fucking call me Billy. To me, that was the, and I kind of felt that way right around episode 4 or 5. I'm like, I said to Laura,
as soon as we saw him, everybody on the internet was like, that's the Man in Black. Mm-hmm. And then it was kind of awesome how they continually gave us evidence that he's absolutely not the Man in Black.
Yeah. So it'll be interesting where they take that. It's going to be interesting to see Clementine's journey. What will be nice about the timing of, because we're doing a pre-record, what will be really interesting is that by the time we get around to the next live episode of Sharing Our Pairings, we'll have wrapped up the season of Westworld, and I'm sure that we'll have probably 20 or 30 minutes to talk about episode 10, which is undoubtedly going to blow us away.
I'm sure.
Yeah. So.
And speaking of Billy, his friend Logan – not friend, his future brother-in-law, Logan.
His asshole boss?
Yeah. A really interesting thing about him is that right off the bat, I was like, he looks a lot like that bad guy that wears like the weird leather jacket.
Hector?
His name. Hector, yes.
Oh, he looks like Hector. Totally looks like
but
Hector.
Then when Maeve pointed out that he had a scar right here, there might have been on this side. And then Dolores cut him right there. Mm-hmm. Cut Logan right there. And then, so what I'm expecting is for Logan to get the scar that Hector has right here.
Yeah.
And then for some reason, I'm expecting something horrible to happen to him where the park has to go into damage control mode and somehow William parlays it into there was an accident that happened and the park isn't at fault. But you have to let me invest, or something like that.
Yeah,
and
yeah, I think it's safe to say for me,
and Logan then and William Hector are the is going to be past, somehow, right? Yeah, And yeah. Hector's somehow going to be a clone version of William at the point where he presumably died.
It does. They certainly seem to fit the profile of, I mean, not the same character, but certainly seems like he's modeled.
Yeah, there's a lot of similarities between the two, which is interesting.
So
he's like a bizarro world version of Logan.
Yeah, so that'll be really interesting. So definitely when we do our live Shangri-La pairings, I'm sure we'll have lots to talk about, and we'll give some pre-spoiler warnings on that. But as I'm freezing my friggin' extremities off here, we'll wrap up the After Dark segment. Any closing thoughts on this episode of Shangri-La Pranks?
No, it was a good episode. I enjoyed it.
Thanks very much, Trip, for being our co-host again. I'm sure that's going to continue going on, provided the weather here cooperates. We might have to do some pre-records as depending on what the weather forecast is, but hopefully in 2 weeks we'll have warmed up here and I won't be freezing so much. So thanks very much for everyone who tuned in for our After Dark segment. If you have any questions or comments for the show, you can email me, surgeon@cigarfederation.com. We see the comments on YouTube and really appreciate those. You can also comment on cigarfederation.com, of course. We post all our shows on there. Make sure to check us out in a couple weeks. We'll be back. And as we share and share our parents, drink better, but drink less.